You mean Lucky poisoned her?
Yes, and I helped her. Then I realized...
Evelyn interrupted him. When you realized what had happened, Lucky pointed out to you that you had written out the prescription, that you had got the drugs, that you and she were in it together. Is that right?
Yes. She said she had done it out of pity. Gail was suffering, that she had begged Lucky to get something that would end it all. A mercy killing, I see. And you believed that?
Edward Hillingdon was silent a moment. Then he said,
No, I didn't really. Not deep down. I accepted it because I wanted to believe it, because I was infatuated with Lucky.
And afterwards, when she married Greg, did you still believe it?
I had made myself believe it by then.
And Greg, how much did he know about it all?
Nothing at all.
That I find hard to believe.
Edward Hillingdon broke out. Evelyn, I've got to get free of it all. That woman taunts me still with what I did. She knows I don't care for her any longer. Care for her? I've come to hate her. But she makes me feel I'm tied to her by the thing we did together.
Evelyn walked up and down the room. Then she stopped and faced him. The entire trouble with you, Edward, is that you are ridiculously sensitive and also incredibly suggestible. That devil of a woman has got you just where she wants you by playing on your sense of guilt. And I'll tell you this in plain Bible terms. The guilt that weighs on you is the guilt of adultery, not murder. You were guilt-stricken about your affair with Lucky. And then she made a cat's paw of you for her murder scheme and managed to make you feel you shared her guilt. You don't.
Evelyn.
He stepped towards her. She stepped back a minute and looked at him searchingly. Is this all true, Edward? Is it? Or are you making it up?
Evelyn, why on earth should I do such a thing?
I don't know, said Evelyn Hillingdon slowly. It's just perhaps because I find it hard to trust anybody. And because... Oh, I don't know. I've got, I suppose, so that I don't know the truth when I hear it.
Let's chuck all this. Go back home to England.
Yes, we will. But not now.
Why not?
We must carry on as usual. Just for the present. It's important. Do you understand, Edward? Don't let Lucky have an inkling of what we're up to. Chapter 13. Exit Victoria Johnson. The evening was drawing to a close. The steel band was at last relaxing its efforts. Tim stood by the dining room, looking over the terrace. He extinguished a few lights on tables that had been vacated. A voice spoke behind him. Tim, can I speak to you a moment? Tim Kendall started.
Hello, Evelyn. Is there anything I can do for you?
Evelyn looked round. Come to this table here and let's sit down a minute. She led the way to a table at the extreme end of the terrace. There were no other people near them. Tim, you must forgive me talking to you, but I'm worried about Molly. His face changed at once.
What about Molly? He said stiffly.
I don't think she's awfully well. She seems upset.
Things do seem to upset her rather easily just lately.
She ought to see a doctor, I think.
Yes, I know, but she doesn't want to. She'd hate it.
Why?
Eh? What do you mean?
I said, why? Why should she hate seeing a doctor?
Well, said Tim rather vaguely, people do sometimes, you know. It sort of makes them feel frightened about themselves.
You're worried about her yourself, aren't you, Tim?
Yes, I am, rather.
Isn't there anyone of her family who could come out here to be with her?
No, that'd make things worse, far worse.
What is the trouble with her family, I mean?
Oh, just one of those things. I suppose she's just highly strung, and she didn't get on with them, particularly her mother. She never has. They're They're rather an odd family in some ways, and she cut loose from them. Good thing she did, I think.
Evelyn said hesitantly, "She seems to have had blackouts, from what she told me, and to be frightened of people. Almost like persecution mania."
"Don't say that," said Tim angrily. "Persecution mania. People always say that about people. Just because she, well, maybe she's a bit nervy, coming out here to the West Indies. You know, people are rather queer sometimes about the West Indies and coloured people."
"Oh, surely not girls like Molly."
"Oh, how does one know the things people are frightened of? There are people who can't be in the room with cats, and other people who faint if a caterpillar drops on them."
"I hate suggesting it, but don't you think perhaps she ought to see a, well, a psychiatrist?"
"No," said Tim explosively. "I won't have people like that monkeying about with her. I don't believe in them. They make people worse. If her mother had left psychiatrists alone..."
"So there was trouble of that kind in her family, was there? I mean, a history of..." She chose the word carefully. "Instability."
"I don't want to talk about it. I took her away from it all, and she was all right. Quite all right. She has just got into a nervous state. But these things aren't hereditary. Everybody knows that nowadays. It's an exploded idea. Molly's perfectly sane. It's just that... Oh, I believe it was that wretched old Palgrave dying that started it all off."
"I see," said Evelyn thoughtfully. "But there was nothing really to worry anyone in Major Palgrave's death, was there?"
"No, of course there wasn't. But it's a kind of shock when somebody dies suddenly."
He looked so desperate and defeated that Evelyn's heart smote her. She put her hand on his arm. "Well, I hope you know what you're doing, Tim. But if I could help in any way, I mean, if I could go with Molly to New York, I could fly with her there, or Miami, or somewhere where she could get really first-class medical advice."
"It's very good of you, Evelyn, but Molly's all right. She's getting over it anyway."
Evelyn shook her head in doubt. She turned away slowly and looked along the line of the terrace. Most people had gone by now to their bungalows. Evelyn was walking towards her table to see if she'd left anything behind there when she heard Tim give an exclamation. She looked up sharply. He was staring towards the steps at the end of the terrace, and she followed his gaze. Then she, too, caught her breath. Molly was coming up the steps from the beach. She was breathing with deep, sobbing breaths. Her body swayed to and fro as she came in a curious, directionless run. Tim cried, "Molly, what's the matter?" He ran towards her, and Evelyn followed him. Molly was at the top of the steps now, and she stood there, both hands behind her back. She said in sobbing breaths,
"I found her. She's there, in the bushes. There, in the bushes. And look at my hands. Look at my hands!"
She held them out, and Evelyn caught her breath as she saw the queer dark stains. They looked dark in the subdued lighting, but she knew well enough that their real colour was red.
"What's happened, Molly?" cried Tim.
"Down there," said Molly. She swayed on her feet. "In the bushes!"
Tim hesitated, looked at Evelyn, then shoved Molly a little towards Evelyn and ran down the steps. Evelyn put her arm round the girl.
"Come, sit down, Molly. Here, you better have something to drink."
Molly collapsed in a chair and leaned forward on the table, her forehead on her crossed arms. Evelyn did not question her any more. She thought it better to leave her time to recover. "It'll be all right, you know," said Evelyn gently. "It'll be all right."
"I don't know," said Molly. "I don't know what happened. I don't know anything. I can't remember. I..."
She raised her head suddenly.
"What's the matter with me? What's the matter with me?"
"It's all right, child. It's all right." Tim was coming slowly up the steps. His face was ghastly. Evelyn looked up at him, raising her eyebrows in a query.
"It's one of our girls," he said. "What's her name? Victoria. Somebody's put a knife in her.
Chapter 14. Inquiry. Molly lay on her bed. Dr. Graham and Dr. Robertson, the West Indian police doctor, stood on one side, Tim on the other. Robertson had his hand on Molly's pulse. He nodded to the man at the foot of the bed, a slender, dark man in police uniform. Inspector Weston, of the St. Honoré Police Force.
A bare statement, no more, the doctor said.
The other nodded.
Now, Mrs. Kendall, just tell us how you came to find this girl.
For a moment or two, it was as though the figure on the bed had not heard. Then she spoke in a faint, faraway voice.
In the bushes. White.
You saw something white and you looked to see what it was, is that it?
Yes, white, lying there. I tried to lift... Blood all over my hands.
She began to tremble. Dr. Graham shook his head at them. Robertson whispered,
She can't stand much more. What were you doing on the beach path, Mrs. Kendall?
Warm, nice, by the sea.
You knew who the girl was?
Victoria, nice girl. Laughs. She used to laugh. Oh, and now she won't. She won't ever laugh again. I'll never forget it.
Her voice rose hysterically.
Molly, don't.
It was Tim.
Quiet.
Dr. Robertson spoke with a soothing authority. Just relax.
Relax.
Now just a small prick. He withdrew the hypodermic. She'll be in no fit condition to be questioned for at least 24 hours, he said. I'll let you know when. The big, handsome Negro looked from one to the other of the men sitting at the table.
I declare to God, he said, that's all I know. I don't know anything but what I've told you.
The perspiration stood out on his forehead. Daventry sighed. The man presiding at the table, Inspector Weston of the St. Honoré CID, made a gesture of dismissal. Big Jim Ellis shuffled out of the room.
It's not all he knows, of course, Weston said.
He had the soft island voice, but it's all we shall learn from him.
You think he's in the clear himself? Asked Daventry.
Yes, they seem to have been on good terms together.
They weren't married.
A faint smile appeared on Inspector Weston's lips.
No, he said, they weren't married. We don't have so many marriages on the island. They christened the children, though. He had 2 children by Victoria.
Do you think he was in it, whatever it was, with her?
Probably not. I think he'd have been nervous of anything of that kind. And I'd say, too, that what she did know wasn't very much.
But enough for blackmail.
I don't know that I'd even call it that. I doubt if the girl would even understand that word. Payment for being discreet isn't thought of as blackmail. You see, some of the people who stay here are the rich playboy lot, and their morals won't bear much investigation.
His voice was slightly scathing.
We get all kinds, I agree, said Daventry. A woman maybe doesn't want it known that she's sleeping around, so she gives a present to the girl who waits on her. It's tacitly understood that the payment's for discretion.
Exactly.
But this, objected Daventry, wasn't anything of that kind. It was murder.
I should doubt, though, if the girl knew it was serious.
She saw something, some puzzling incident, something to do, presumably, with this bottle of pills.
It belonged to Mr. Dyson, I understand.
We'd better see him next.
Gregory came in with his usual hearty air.
Here I am, he said. What can I do to help? Too bad about this girl. She was a nice girl. We both liked her. I suppose it was some sort of quarrel or other with a man, but she seemed quite happy and no signs of being in trouble about anything. I was kidding her only last night.
I believe you take a preparation, Mr. Dyson, called Serenite.
Quite right, little pink tablets.
You have them on prescription from a physician?
Yes, I can show it to you if you like. Suffer a bit from high blood pressure, like so many people do nowadays.
Very few people seem to be aware of that fact.
Well, I don't go talking about it. I've always been well and hearty, and I never like people who talk about their ailments all the time.
How many of the pills do you take?
2, 3 times a day.
Do you have a fairly large stock with you?
Yes, I've got about 6 bottles, but they're locked up, you know, in a suitcase. I only keep out one, the one that's in current use.
And you missed this bottle a short time ago, so I hear.
Quite right.
And you asked this girl, Victoria Johnson, whether she'd seen it.
Yes, I did.
And what did she say?
She said the last time she'd seen it was on the shelf in our bathroom. She said she'd look around.
And after that?
She came and returned the bottle to me sometime later. She said, was this the bottle that was missing?
And you said?
I said, that's it, all right. Where did you find it? And she said it was in old Major Palgrave's room. I said, how on earth did it get there?
And what did she answer to that?
She said she didn't know, but...
He hesitated. Yes, Mr. Dyson?
Well, she gave me the feeling that she did know a little more than she was saying, but I didn't pay much attention. After all, it wasn't very important. As I say, I've got other bottles of the pills with me. I thought perhaps I'd left it around in the restaurant or somewhere, and old Palgrave picked it up for some reason. Perhaps he put it in his pocket, meaning to return it to me, then forgot.
And that's all you know about it, Mr. Dyson?
That's all I know. Sorry to be so unhelpful. Is it important? Why?
Weston shrugged his shoulders.
As things are, anything may be important. I don't see where pills come in. I thought you'd want to know about what my movements were when this wretched girl was stabbed. I've written them all down as carefully as I can.
Weston looked at him thoughtfully. Indeed. That was very helpful of you, Mr. Dyson.
Save everybody trouble, I thought, said Greg.
He shoved a piece of paper across the table. Weston studied it, and Daventry drew his chair a little closer and looked over his shoulder.
That seems very clear, said Weston, after a moment or two. You and your wife were changing together for dinner in your bungalow until 9:10. You then went along to the terrace, where you had drinks, with Signora de Caspiaro. At 9:15, Colonel and Mrs. Hillingdon joined you, and you went in to dine. As far as you can remember, you went off to bed at about 11:30.
Of course, said Greg. I don't know what time the girl was actually killed.
There was a faint semblance of a question in the words. Inspector Weston, however, did not appear to notice it.
Mrs. Kendall found her, I understand. Must have been a very nasty shock for her.
Yes, Dr. Robertson had to give her a sedative.
This was quite late, wasn't it, when most people had trundled off to bed?
Yes.
Had she been dead long, when Mrs. Kendall found her, I mean?
We are not quite certain of the exact time yet, said Weston smoothly.
Poor little Molly. It must have been a nasty shock for her. Matter of fact, I didn't notice her about last night. Thought she might have had a headache or something and was lying down.
When was the last time you did see Mrs. Kendall?
Oh, quite early, before I went to change. She was playing about with some of the table decorations and things, rearranging the knives.
I see.
She was quite cheerful then, said Greg. Kidding and all that. She's a great girl. We're all very fond of her. Tim's a lucky fellow.
Well, thank you, Mr. Dyson. You can't remember anything more than you've told us about what the girl Victoria said when she returned the tablets?
No, it was just as I say. Asked me were these the tablets I'd been asking for, said she'd found them in old Palgrave's room.
She'd no idea who put them there.
Don't think so. Can't remember, really.
Thank you, Mr. Dyson.
Gregory went out.
Very thoughtful of him, said Weston, gently tapping the paper with his fingernail, to be so anxious to want us to know for sure exactly where he was last night.
A little over-anxious, do you think? Asked Daventry.
That's very difficult to tell. There are people, you know, who are naturally nervous about their own safety, about being mixed up with anything. It isn't necessarily because they have any guilty knowledge. On the other hand, it might be just that.
What about opportunity?
Nobody's really got much of an alibi, what with the band and the dancing and the coming and going. People are getting up, leaving their tables, coming back. Women go to powder their noses. Men take a stroll. Dyson could have slipped away. Anybody could have slipped away. But he does seem rather anxious to prove that he didn't.
He looked thoughtfully down at the paper.
So, Mrs. Kendall was rearranging knives on the table, he said. I rather wonder if he dragged that in on purpose.
Did it sound like it to you?
The other considered. I think it's possible.
Outside the room where the two men were sitting, a noise had arisen.
A high voice was demanding admittance, shrilly.
I've got something to tell. I've got something to tell. You take me into where the gentlemen are. You take me into where the policeman is.
A uniformed policeman pushed open the door.
It's one of the cooks here, he said. Very anxious to see you. Says he's got something you ought to know.
A frightened, dark man in a cook's cap pushed past him and came into the room. It was one of the minor cooks, a Cuban, not a native of Saint-Honoré.
I tell you something, I tell you, he said. She come through my kitchen, she did, and she had a knife with her. A knife, I tell you. She had a knife in her hand. She come through my kitchen and out the door, out into the garden. I saw her.
Now, calm down, said Daventry. Calm down. Who are you talking about?
I tell you who I'm talking about. I'm talking about the boss's wife, Mrs. Kendall. I'm talking about her. She had a knife in her hand, and she go out into the dark. Before dinner, that was. And she didn't come back.
Chapter 15. Inquiry continued.
Can we have a word with you, Mr. Kendall?
Of course.
Tim looked up from his desk. He pushed some papers aside and indicated chairs. His face was drawn and miserable.
How are you getting on? Got any forwarder? There seems to be a doom in this place. People are wanting to leave, you know, asking about air passages, just when it seemed everything was being a success. Oh, Lord, you don't know what it means, this place, to me and to Molly. We staked everything on it.
It's very hard on you, I know, said Inspector Weston. Don't think that we don't sympathize.
If it all could be cleared up quickly, said Tim. This wretched girl, Victoria. Oh, I oughtn't to talk about her like that. She was quite a good sort, Victoria was. But there must be some quite simple reason, some kind of intrigue or love affair she had. Perhaps her husband.
Jim Ellis wasn't her husband, and they seemed a settled sort of couple.
If it could only be cleared up quickly, said Tim again.
I'm sorry. You wanted to talk to me about something. Ask me something.
Yes, it was about last night. According to medical evidence, Victoria was killed sometime between 10:30 p.m. and midnight. Alibis, under the circumstances that prevail here, are not very easy to prove. People are moving about, dancing, walking away from the terrace, coming back. It's all very difficult.
I suppose so. But does that mean that you definitely consider Victoria was killed by one of the guests here?
Well, we have to examine that possibility, Mr. Kendall. What I want to ask you particularly about is a statement made by one of your cooks.
Oh?
Which one? What does he say?
He's a Cuban, I understand.
We've got two Cubans and a Puerto Rican.
This man, Enrico, states that your wife passed through the kitchen on her way from the dining room and went out into the garden and that she was carrying a knife.
Tim stared at him.
Molly carrying a knife? Well, why shouldn't she? I mean, why... You don't think... What are you trying to suggest?
I'm talking of the time before people had come into the dining room. It would be, I suppose, sometime about 8:30. You yourself were in the dining room talking to the head waiter, Fernando, I believe.
Yes. Tim cast his mind back. Yes, I remember.
And your wife came in from the terrace?
Yes, she did, Tim agreed. She always went out to look over the tables. Sometimes the boys set things wrong, forgot some of the cutlery, things like that. Very likely that's what it was. She may have been rearranging cutlery or something. She might have had a spare knife or a spoon, something like that, in her hand.
And she came from the terrace into the dining room. Did she speak to you?
Yes, we had a word or two together.
What did she say? Can you remember?
I think I asked her who she'd been talking to. I heard her voice out there.
And who did she say she'd been talking to?
Gregory Dyson.
Ah, yes, that is what he said.
Tim went on. He'd been making a pass at her, I understand. He was a bit given to that kind of thing. It annoyed me, and I said, blast him, and Molly laughed and said she could do all the blasting that needed to be done. Molly's a very clever girl that way. It's not always an easy position, you know. You can't offend guests, and so an attractive girl like Molly has to pass things off with a laugh and a shrug. Gregory Dyson finds it difficult to keep his hands off any good-looking woman.
Had there been any altercation between them?
No, I don't think so. I think, as I say, she just laughed it off as usual.
You can't say definitely whether she had a knife in her hand or not.
I can't remember. I'm almost sure she didn't. In fact, I'm quite sure she didn't.
But you said just now...
Look here! What I meant was that if she was in the dining room or in the kitchen, it's quite likely she might have picked up a knife or had one in her hand. Matter of fact, I can remember quite well. She came in from the dining room and she had nothing in her hand. Nothing at all. That's definite.
I see, said Weston. Tim looked at him uneasily.
What on earth is this you're getting at? What did that damn fool Enrico Manuel, whatever it was, say?
He said your wife came out into the kitchen, that she looked upset, that she had a knife in her hand.
He's just dramatizing.
Did you have any further conversation with your wife during dinner or after?
No, I don't think I did, really. Matter of fact, I was rather busy.
Was your wife there in the dining room during the meal?
Oh, yes. We always move about among the guests and things like that, see how things are going on.
Did you speak to her at all?
No, I don't think I did. We're usually fairly busy. We don't always notice what the other one's doing, and we certainly haven't got time to talk to each other.
Actually, you don't remember speaking to her until she came up the steps 3 hours later after finding the body.
It was an awful shock for her. It upset her terribly.
I know. A very unpleasant experience. How did she come to be walking along the beach path?
After the stress of dinner being served, she often does go for a turn. You know, get away from the guests for a minute or two, get a breather.
When she came back, I understand you were talking to Mrs. Hillingdon.
Yes, practically everyone else had gone to bed.
What was the subject of your conversation with Mrs. Hillingdon?
Nothing particular. Why, what's she been saying?
So far, she hasn't said anything. We haven't asked her.
We were just talking of this and that, Molly and hotel running and one thing and another.
And then your wife came up the steps of the terrace and told you what had happened.
Yes.
There was blood on her hands?
Of course there was. She'd bent over the girl, tried to lift her, couldn't understand what had happened, what was the matter with her. Of course there was blood on her hands. Look here. What the hell are you suggesting? You are suggesting something?
Please calm down,
said Daventry. It's all a great strain on you, I know, Tim, but we have to get the facts clear. I understand your wife hasn't been feeling very well lately.
Nonsense, she's all right. Major Palgrave's death upset her a bit. Naturally, she's a sensitive girl.
We shall have to ask her a few questions as soon as she's fit enough, said Weston.
Well, you can't now. The doctor gave her a sedative and said she wasn't to be disturbed. I won't have her upset and browbeaten, do you hear?
We are not going to do any browbeating, said Weston. We've just got to get the facts clear. We won't disturb her at present, but as soon as the doctor allows us, we'll have to see her. His voice was gentle, inflexible. Tim looked at him, opened his mouth, but said nothing. Evelyn Hillingdon, calm and composed as usual, sat down in the chair indicated. She considered the few questions asked her, taking her time over it. Her dark, intelligent eyes looked at Weston thoughtfully. "Yes," she said. "I was talking to Mr. Kendall on the terrace when his wife came up the steps and told us about the murder."
"Your husband wasn't there?"
"No, he'd gone to bed."
"Had you any special reason for your conversation with Mr. Kendall?"
Evelyn raised her finely penciled eyebrows. It was a definite rebuke. She said coldly, "What a very odd question." "No, there was nothing special about our conversation."
"Did you discuss the matter of his wife's health?"
Again Evelyn took her time. "I really can't remember," she said at last.
"Are you sure of that?"
"Sure that I can't remember? What a curious way of putting it. One talks about so many things at different times."
"Mrs. Kendall has not been in good health lately, I understand."
"She looked quite all right. A little tired, perhaps. Of course, running a place like this means a lot of worries, and she is quite inexperienced. Naturally, she gets flustered now and then."
"Flustered?" Weston repeated the word. "That was the way you would describe it?"
"It's an old-fashioned word, perhaps, but just as good as the modern jargon we use for everything. A virus infection for a bilious attack, an anxiety neurosis for the minor bothers of daily life."
Her smile made Weston feel slightly ridiculous. He thought to himself that Evelyn Hillingdon was a clever woman. He looked at Daventry, whose face remained unmoved, and wondered what he thought.
"Thank you, Mrs. Hillingdon," said Weston.
"We don't want to worry you, Mrs. Kendall, but we have to have your account of just how you came to find this girl. Dr. Graham says you're sufficiently recovered to talk about it now."
"Oh, yes," said Molly. "I'm really quite all right again."
She gave them a small, nervous smile. "It was just the shock. It was rather awful, you know."
"Yes, indeed, it must have been.
I understand you went for a walk after dinner."
"Yes, I often do."
Her eyes shifted, Daventry noticed, and the fingers of her hands twined and untwined about each other.
"What time would that have been, Mrs. Kendall?" asked Weston.
"Well, I don't really know. We don't go much by the time."
"The steel band was still playing?"
"Yes, at least I think so. I can't really remember."
"And you walked which way?"
"Oh, along the beach path."
"To the left or the right?"
"Oh, first one way and then the other. I really didn't notice."
"Why didn't you notice, Mrs. Kendall?" She frowned.
"I suppose I was, well, thinking of things."
"Thinking of anything particular?"
No, nothing particular. Just things that had to be done, seen to, in the hotel."
Again that nervous twining and untwining of fingers.
"And then I noticed something white in a clump of hibiscus bushes, and I wondered what it was. I stopped and pulled."
She swallowed convulsively.
"And it was her, Victoria, all huddled up. And I tried to raise her head up, and I got blood on my hands."
She looked at them and repeated, wonderingly, as though recalling something impossible,
blood on my hands.
Yes, yes. A very dreadful experience. There is no need for you to tell us more about that part of it. How long had you been walking, do you think, when you found her?
I don't know. I have no idea.
An hour? Half an hour? Or more than an hour?
I don't know,
Molly repeated. Daventry asked in a quiet, everyday voice, Did you take a knife with you on your walk?
A knife? Molly sounded surprised. Why should I take a knife?
I only ask because one of the kitchen staff mentioned that you had a knife in your hand when you went out of the kitchen into the garden. Molly frowned.
But I didn't go out of the kitchen. Oh, you mean earlier, before dinner? I don't think so.
You'd been rearranging the cutlery on the tables, perhaps?
I have to sometimes. They lay things wrong, not enough knives or too many, the wrong number of forks and spoons, that sort of thing.
And did that happen on this particular evening?
It may have done, something like that. It's really automatic. One doesn't think or remember.
So you may have gone out of the kitchen that evening carrying a knife in your hand.
I don't think I did. I'm sure I didn't, she added. Tim was there. He would know. Ask him.
Did you like this girl, Victoria? Was she good at her work? Asked Weston.
Yes, she was a very nice girl.
And you had no dispute with her?
Dispute? No.
She had never threatened you in any way.
Threatened me? What do you mean?
It doesn't matter. You have no idea of who could have killed her. No idea at all?
None.
She spoke positively. Well, thank you, Mrs. Kendall. He smiled. It wasn't so terrible, was it?
That's all?
That's all for now.
Daventry got up, opened the door for her, and watched her go out.
Tim would know, he quoted as he returned to his chair. And Tim says definitely that she didn't have a knife.
Weston said gravely, I think that is what any husband would feel called upon to say.
A table knife seems a very poor type of knife to use for murder.
But it was a steak knife, Mr. Daventry. Steaks were on the menu that evening. Steak knives are kept sharp.
I really can't bring myself to believe that that girl we've just been talking to is a red-handed murderess, Weston.
It is not necessary to believe it yet. It could be that Mrs. Kendall went out into the garden before dinner clasping a knife she had taken off one of the tables because it was superfluous. She might not even have noticed she was holding it, and she could have put it down somewhere or dropped it. It could have been found and used by someone else. I, too, think her an unlikely murderess.
All the same, said Daventry thoughtfully, I'm pretty sure she's not telling all she knows. Her vagueness over time is odd. Where was she? What was she doing out there?
Nobody so far seems to have noticed her in the dining room that evening.
The husband was about as usual, but not the wife.
You think she went to meet someone?
Victoria Johnson?
Perhaps. Or perhaps she saw whoever it was who did go to meet Victoria.
You're thinking of Gregory Dyson.
We know he was talking to Victoria earlier. He may have arranged to meet her again later. Everyone moved around freely on the terrace, remember? Dancing, drinking, in and out of the bar?
No alibi like a steel band, said Daventry wryly.
Chapter 16. Miss Marple Seeks Assistance. If anybody had been there to observe the gentle-looking elderly lady who stood meditatively on the loggia outside her bungalow, they would have thought she had nothing more on her mind than deliberation on how to arrange her time that day. An expedition, perhaps, to Castle Cliff, a visit to Jamestown,
a nice drive and lunch at Pelican Point, or just a quiet morning on the beach. But the gentle old lady was deliberating quite other matters. She was in a militant mood. "Something has got to be done," said Miss Marple to herself. Moreover, she was convinced that there was no time to be lost. There was urgency. But who was there that she could convince of that fact? Given time, she thought she could find out the truth by herself. She had found out a good deal, but not enough, not nearly enough, and time was short. She realized bitterly that here on this paradise of an island she had none of her usual allies. She thought regretfully of her friends in England, Sir Henry Clithering, always willing to listen indulgently, his godson, Dermot, who, in spite of his increased status at Scotland Yard, was still ready to believe that when Miss Marple voiced an opinion there was usually something behind it. But would that soft-voiced native police officer pay any attention to an old lady's urgency? Dr. Graham. But Dr. Graham was not what she needed. Too gentle and hesitant, certainly not a man of quick decisions and rapid actions. Miss Marple, feeling rather like a humble deputy of the Almighty, almost cried aloud her need in biblical phrasing. "Who will go for me? Whom shall I send?" The sound that reached her ears a moment later was not instantly recognized by her as an answer to prayer. Far from it. At the back of her mind it registered only as a man possibly calling his dog.
"Hi!"
Miss Marple, lost in perplexity, paid no attention.
"Hi!"
The volume thus increased. Miss Marple looked vaguely round.
"Hi!"
called Mr. Raphael impatiently. He added, "You there!" Miss Marple had not at first realized that Mr. Raphael's "Hi, you!" was addressed to her. It was not a method that anyone had ever used before to summon her. It was certainly not a gentlemanly mode of address. Miss Marple did not resent it, because people seldom did resent Mr. Raphael's somewhat arbitrary method of doing things. He was a law unto himself, and people accepted him as such. Miss Marple looked across the intervening space between her bungalow and his. Mr. Raphael was sitting outside on his loggia, and he beckoned her.
"You were calling me?" she asked.
"Of course I was calling you," said Mr. Raphael. "Who did you think I was calling, a cat? Come over here."
Miss Marple looked round for her handbag, picked it up, and crossed the intervening space.
"I can't come to you unless someone helps me," explained Mr. Raphael. "So you've got to come to me."
"Oh, yes," said Miss Marple. "I quite understand that." Mr. Raphael pointed to an adjacent chair.
"Sit down," he said. "I want to talk to you. Something damned odd is going on in this island."
"Yes, indeed," agreed Miss Marple, taking the chair as indicated. By sheer habit, she drew her knitting out of her bag.
"Don't start knitting again," said Mr. Raphael. "I can't stand it. I hate women knitting. It irritates me."
Miss Marple returned her knitting to her bag. She did this with no undue air of meekness, rather with the air of one who makes allowances for a fractious patient.
"There's a lot of chit-chat going on," said Mr. Raphael, "and I bet you're in the forefront of it, you and the parson and his sister."
"It is perhaps only natural that there should be chit-chat," said Miss Marple with spirit, "given the circumstances."
"This island girl gets herself knifed, found in the bushes. Might be ordinary enough. That chap she was living with might have got jealous of another man. Or he's got himself another girl and she got jealous and they had a row. Sex in the tropics, that sort of stuff. What do you say?"
"No," said Miss Marple, shaking her head.
"The authorities don't think so either."
"They would say more to you," pointed out Miss Marple, "than they would say to me."
"All the same, I bet you know more about it than I do. You've listened to the tittle-tattle."
"Certainly I have," said Miss Marple.
"Nothing much else to do, have you, except listen to tittle-tattle?"
"It is often informative and useful."
"Do you know," said Mr. Raphael, studying her attentively, "I made a mistake about you. I don't often make mistakes about people. There's a lot more to you than I thought there was. All these rumours about Major Palgrave and the stories he told. You think he was bumped off, don't you?
I very much fear so, said Miss Marple.
Well, he was, said Mr. Raphael.
Miss Marple drew a deep breath.
That is definite, is it? She asked.
Yes, it's definite enough. I had it from Daventry. I'm not breaking a confidence because the facts of the autopsy will have to come out. You told Graham something. He went to Daventry. Daventry went to the administrator. The CID were informed, and between them they agreed that things looked fishy, so they dug up old Palgrave and had a look.
And they found?
Miss Marple paused, interrogatively.
They found he'd had a lethal dose of something that only a doctor could pronounce properly. As far as I remember, it sounds vaguely like difluorhexagonal ethyl carbenzol. I mean, that's not the right name, but that's roughly what it sounds like. The police doctor put it that way so that nobody should know, I suppose, what it really was. The stuff's probably got some quite simple, nice, easy name like Evipan or Veranol or Eastern Syrup or something of that kind. This is its official name to baffle laymen with. Anyway, a sizeable dose of it, I gather, would produce death, and the signs would be much the same as those of high blood pressure aggravated by overindulging in alcohol on a gay evening. In fact, it all looked perfectly natural, and nobody questioned it for a moment. Just said, poor old chap, and buried him quick. Now they wonder if he ever had high blood pressure at all. Did he ever say he had to you?
No.
Exactly. And yet everyone seems to have taken it as a fact.
Apparently he told people he had.
It's like seeing ghosts, said Mr. Raphael. You never meet the chap who's seen the ghost himself. It's always the second cousin of his aunt, or a friend, or a friend of a friend. But leave that for a moment. They thought he had blood pressure because there was a bottle of tablets controlling blood pressure found in his room. But, and now we're coming to the point, I gathered that this girl who was killed went about saying that that bottle was put there by somebody else, and that actually it belonged to that fellow Greg.
Mr. Dyson has got high blood pressure. His wife mentioned it, said Miss Marple.
So it was put in Palgrave's room to suggest that he suffered from high blood pressure and to make his death seem natural.
Exactly, said Miss Marple. And the story was put about very cleverly that he had frequently mentioned to people that he had high blood pressure. But, you know, it's very easy to put about a story. Very easy. I've seen a lot of it in my time.
I bet you have, said Mr. Raphael.
It only needs a murmur here and there, said Miss Marple.
You don't say it of your own knowledge. You just say that Mrs. B told you that Colonel C told her. It's always at second hand or third hand or fourth hand. And it's very difficult to find out who was the original whisperer. Oh, yes, it can be done. And the people you say it to go on and repeat it to others, as if they know it of their own knowledge.
Somebody's been clever, said Mr. Raphael thoughtfully.
Yes, said Miss Marple. I think somebody's been quite clever.
This girl saw something or knew something and tried blackmail, I suppose, said Mr. Raphael.
She mayn't have thought of it as blackmail, said Miss Marple. In these large hotels there are often things the maids know that some people would rather not have repeated, and so they hand out a larger tip or a little present of money. The girl possibly didn't realise at first the importance of what she knew.
Still, she got a knife in her back all right, said Mr. Raphael brutally.
Yes, evidently someone couldn't afford to let her talk.
Well, let's hear what you think about it all.
Miss Marple looked at him thoughtfully.
Why should you think I know any more than you do, Mr. Raphael?
Probably you don't, said Mr. Raphael, but I'm interested to hear your ideas about what you do know.
But why?
There's not very much to do out here, said Mr. Raphael. Except make money.
Miss Marple looked slightly surprised.
Make money out here?
You can send out half a dozen cables in code every day, if you like, said Mr. Raphael. That's how I amuse myself.
Takeover bids? Miss Marple asked doubtfully, in the tone of one who speaks a foreign language.
That kind of thing, agreed Mr. Raphael, pitting your wits against other people's wits. The trouble is, it doesn't occupy enough time, so I've got interested in this business. It's aroused my curiosity. Palgrave spent a good deal of his time talking to you. Nobody else would be bothered with him, I expect. What did he say?
He told me a good many stories, said Miss Marple.
I know he did. Damn boring, most of them. And you didn't only have to hear them once. If you got anywhere within range, you heard them three or four times over.
I know, said Miss Marple. I'm afraid that does happen when gentlemen get older.
Mr. Raphael looked at her very sharply. I don't tell stories, he said. Go on. It started with one of Palgrave's stories, did it?
He said he knew a murderer, said Miss Marple. There's nothing really special about that, she added in her gentle voice, because I suppose it happens to nearly everybody.
I don't follow you, said Mr. Raphael.
I don't mean specifically, said Miss Marple. But surely, Mr. Raphael, if you cast over in your mind your recollections of various events in your life, hasn't there nearly always been an occasion when somebody has made some careless reference, such as, "Oh, yes, I knew the so-and-sos quite well. He died very suddenly, and they always say his wife did him in. But I dare say that's just gossip." You've heard people say something like that, haven't you?
Well, I suppose so. Yes, something of the kind. But not, well, not seriously.
Exactly, said Miss Marple. But Major Palgrave was a very serious man. I think he enjoyed telling this story. He said he had a snapshot of the murderer. He was going to show it to me, but actually he didn't.
Why?
Because he saw something, said Miss Marple. Saw someone, I suspect. His face got very red, and he shoved back the snapshot into his wallet and began talking on another subject.
Who did he see?
I've thought about that a good deal, said Miss Marple. I was sitting outside my bungalow, and he was sitting nearly opposite me, and whatever he saw over my right shoulder.
Someone coming along the path, then, from behind you, on the right, the path from the creek and the car park?
Yes.
Was anyone coming along the path?
Mr. and Mrs. Dyson, and Colonel and Mrs. Hillingdon.
Anybody else?
Not that I can find out. Of course, your bungalow would also be in his line of vision.
Ah, then we include, shall we say, Esther Walters and my chap Jackson. Is that right? Either of them, I suppose, might have come out of the bungalow and gone back inside again without your seeing them.
They might have, said Miss Marple. I didn't turn my head at once.
The Dysons, the Hillingdons, Esther, Jackson. One of them's a murderer. Or, of course, myself, he added, obviously as an afterthought.
Miss Marple smiled faintly.
And he spoke of the murderer as a man?
Yes.
Right. That cuts out Evelyn Hillingdon, Lucky and Esther Walters. So your murderer, allowing that all this far-fetched nonsense is true, your murderer is Dyson, Hillingdon, or my smooth-tongued Jackson.
Or yourself, said Miss Marple.
Mr. Raphael ignored this last point. Don't say things to irritate me, he said. I'll tell you the first thing that strikes me, and which you don't seem to have thought of.
If it's one of those three, why the devil didn't old Palgrave recognise him before?
Dash it all, they've all been sitting round looking at each other for the last 2 weeks. That doesn't seem to make sense.
I think it could, said Miss Marple.
Well, tell me how.
You see, in Major Palgrave's story, he hadn't seen this man himself at any time. It was a story told to him by a doctor. The doctor gave him the snapshot as a curiosity. Major Palgrave may have looked at the snapshot fairly closely at the time, but after that, he'd just stack it away in his wallet and keep it as a souvenir.
Occasionally, perhaps he'd take it out and show it to someone he was telling the story to. And another thing, Mr. Raphael, we don't know how long ago this happened. He didn't give me any indication of that when he was telling the story. I mean, this may have been a story he'd been telling to people for years. 5 years, 10 years, longer still, perhaps. Some of his tiger stories go back about 20 years.
They would, said Mr. Raphael.
So I don't suppose for a moment that Major Palgrave would recognize the face in the snapshot if he came across the man casually. What I think happened, what I'm almost sure must have happened, is that as he told his story, he fumbled for the snapshot, took it out, looked down at it, studying the face, and then looked up to see the same face, or one with a strong resemblance, coming towards him from a distance of about 10 or 12 feet away.
Yes, said Mr. Raphael consideringly. Yes, that's possible.
He was taken aback, said Miss Marple, and he shoved it back in his wallet and began to talk loudly about something else.
He couldn't have been sure, said Mr. Raphael shrewdly.
No, said Miss Marple, he couldn't have been sure. But, of course, afterwards, he would have studied the snapshot very carefully and would have looked at the man and tried to make up his mind whether it was just a likeness or whether it could actually be the same person.
Mr. Raphael reflected a moment or two. Then he shook his head. There's something wrong here. The motive's inadequate, absolutely inadequate.
He was speaking to you loudly, was he?
Yes, said Miss Marple, quite loudly. He always did.
True enough. Yes, he did shout. So, whoever was approaching would hear what he said.
I should imagine you could hear it for quite a good radius round.
Mr. Raphael shook his head again. He said, it's fantastic. Too fantastic. Anybody would laugh at such a story. Here's an old booby telling a story about another story somebody told him, and showing a snapshot, and all of it centering round a murder which had taken place years ago, or at any rate a year or two. How on earth can that worry the man in question? No evidence, just a bit of hearsay, a story at third hand. He could even admit a likeness. He could say, yes, I do look rather like that fellow, don't I? Ha ha! Nobody's going to take old Palgrave's identification seriously. Don't tell me so, because I won't believe it. No, the chap, if it was the chap, had nothing to fear, nothing whatever. It's the kind of accusation he can just laugh off. Why on earth should he proceed to murder old Palgrave? It's absolutely unnecessary. You must see that.
Oh, I do see that, said Miss Marple. I couldn't agree with you more. That's what makes me uneasy. So very uneasy that I really couldn't sleep last night.
Mr. Raphael stared at her. Let's hear what's on your mind, he said quietly.
I may be entirely wrong, said Miss Marple hesitantly.
Probably you are, said Raphael with his usual lack of courtesy. But at any rate, let's hear what you've thought up in the small hours.
There could be a very powerful motive if...
If what?
If there was going to be, quite soon, another murder.
Mr. Raphael stared at her.
He tried to pull himself up a little in his chair.
Let's get this clear, he said.
I am so bad at explaining. Miss Marple spoke rapidly and rather incoherently. A pink flush rose to her cheeks. Supposing there was a murder planned. If you remember, the story Major Palgrave told me concerned a man whose wife died under suspicious circumstances. Then, after a certain lapse of time, there was another murder under exactly the same circumstances. A man of a different name had a wife who died in much the same way. And the doctor who was telling it recognized him as the same man, although he'd changed his name. Well, it does look, doesn't it, as though the murderer might be the kind of murderer who made a habit of the thing.
You mean like Smith, brides in the bath, that kind of thing?
Yes.
As far as I can make out, said Miss Marple, and from what I have heard and read, a man who does a wicked thing like this and gets away with it the first time is, alas, encouraged. He thinks it's easy. He thinks he's clever, and so he repeats it. And in the end, as you say, like Smith and the brides in the bath, it becomes a habit. Each time in a different place, and each time the man changes his name, but the crimes themselves are all very much alike. So it seems to me, although I may be quite wrong...
But you don't think you are wrong, do you? Mr. Raphael put in shrewdly.
Miss Marple went on without answering. That if that were so, and if this person had got things all lined up for a murder out here, for getting rid of another wife, say, and if this is crime 3 or 4, well then, the major story would matter, because the murderer couldn't afford to have any similarity pointed out. If you remember, that was exactly the way Smith got caught. The circumstances of a crime attracted the attention of somebody who compared it with a newspaper clipping of some other case. So you do see, don't you, that if this wicked person has got a crime planned, arranged, and shortly about to take place, he couldn't afford to let Major Palgrave go about telling this story and showing that snapshot. She stopped and looked appealingly at Mr. Raphael. So you see, he had to do something very quickly as possible.
Mr. Raphael spoke. In fact, that very same night, eh?
Yes, said Miss Marple.
Quick work, said Mr. Raphael. But it could be done. Put the tablets in old Palgrave's room, spread the blood pressure rumour about, and add a little of our 14-syllable drug to a planter's punch. Is that it?
Yes. But that's all over. We needn't worry about it. It's the future. It's now. With Major Palgrave out of the way and the snapshot destroyed, this man will go on with his murder as planned.
Mr. Raphael whistled. You've got it all worked out, haven't you?
Miss Marple nodded. She said in a most unaccustomed voice, firm and almost dictatorial, And we've got to stop it. You've got to stop it, Mr. Raphael.
Me? Said Mr. Raphael, astonished. Why me?
Because you're rich and important, said Miss Marple, simply. People will take notice of what you say or suggest. They wouldn't listen to me for a moment. They would say that I was an old lady imagining things.
They might at that, said Mr. Raphael. More fools if they did. I must say, though, that nobody would think you had any brains in your head to hear your usual line of talk. Actually, you've got a logical mind. Very few women have.
He shifted himself uncomfortably in his chair.
Where the hell's Esther or Jackson? He said. I need resettling. No, it's no good. You're doing it. You're not strong enough. I don't know what they mean, leaving me alone like this.
I'll go and find them.
No, you won't. You'll stay here and thrash this out. Which of them is it? The egregious Greg, the quiet Edward Hillingdon, or my fellow Jackson? It's got to be one of the three, hasn't it?
Chapter 17. Mr. Raphael takes charge. I don't know, said Miss Marple.
What do you mean? What have we been talking about for the last 20 minutes?
It has occurred to me that I may have been wrong.
Mr. Raphael stared at her. Scatty, after all, he said disgustedly. And you sounded so sure of yourself.
Oh, I am sure. About the murder. It's the murderer I'm not sure about. You see, I found out that Major Palgrave had more than one murder story. You told me yourself he told you one about a kind of Lucretia Borgia.
So he did, at that. But that was quite a different kind of story.
I know. And Mrs. Walters said he had one about someone being gassed in a gas oven.
But the story he told you...
Miss Marple allowed herself to interrupt, a thing that did not often happen to Mr. Raphael. She spoke with desperate earnestness and only moderate incoherence. Don't you see? It's so difficult to be sure. The whole point is that so often one doesn't listen.
Ask Mrs. Walters. She said the same thing. You listen to begin with, and then your attention flags, your mind wanders, and suddenly you find you've missed a bit. I just wonder if possibly there may have been a gap, a very small one, between the story he was telling me about a man and the moment when he was getting out his wallet and saying, "Like to see a picture of a murderer."
But you thought it was a picture of the man he had been talking about.
I thought so, yes. It never occurred to me that it mightn't have been. But now, how can I be sure?
Mr. Raphael looked at her very thoughtfully.
"The trouble with you is," he said, "that you're too conscientious. Great mistake. Make up your mind and don't shilly-shally. You didn't shilly-shally to begin with. If you ask me, in all this chit-chat you've been having with the parson's sister and the rest of them, you've got hold of something that's unsettled you."
"Perhaps you're right."
"Well, cut it out for the moment. Let's go ahead with what you had to begin with. Because 9 times out of 10, one's original judgments are right. Or so I've found. We've got 3 suspects. Let's take 'em out and have a good look at them. Any preference?"
"I really haven't," said Miss Marple. "All 3 of them seem so very unlikely."
"We'll take Greg first," said Mr. Raphael. "Can't stand the fellow. Doesn't make him a murderer, though. Still, there are 1 or 2 points against him. Those blood pressure tablets belong to him. Nice and handy to make use of."
"That would be a little obvious, wouldn't it?" Miss Marple objected.
"I don't know that it would," said Mr. Raphael. "After all, the main thing was to do something quickly, and he'd got the tablets. Hadn't much time to go looking round for tablets that somebody else might have. Let's say it's Greg. All right. If he wanted to put his dear wife Lucky out of the way, good job too, I'd say. In fact, I'm in sympathy with him. I can't actually see his motive. From all accounts, he's rich. Inherited money from his first wife, who had pots of it. He qualifies on that as a possible wife murderer, all right, but that's over and done with. He got away with it. But Lucky was his first wife's poor relation. No money there. So if he wants to put her out of the way, it must be in order to marry somebody else. Any gossip going around about that?"
Miss Marple shook her head.
"Not that I have heard. He, has a very gallant manner with all the ladies."
"Well, that's a nice old-fashioned way of putting it," said Mr. Raphael. "All right, he's a stoat, he makes passes. Not enough, we want more than that. Let's go on to Edward Hillingdon. Now there's a dark horse, if ever there was one."
"He is not, I think, a happy man," offered Miss Marple. Mr. Raphael looked at her thoughtfully.
"Do you think a murderer ought to be a happy man?"
Miss Marple coughed.
"Well, they usually have been, in my experience."
"I don't suppose your experience has gone very far," said Mr. Raphael.
In this assumption, as Miss Marple could have told him, he was wrong, but she forbore to contest his statement. Gentlemen, she knew, did not like to be put right in their facts.
"I rather fancy Hillingdon myself," said Mr. Raphael. "I've an idea that there is something a bit odd going on between him and his wife. You noticed it at all?"
"Oh, yes," said Miss Marple. "I have noticed it. Their behaviour is perfect in public, of course, but that one would expect."
"You probably know more about those sort of people than I would," said Mr. Raphael. "Very well, then. Everything is in perfectly good taste, but it's a probability that, in a gentlemanly way, Edward Hillingdon is contemplating doing away with Evelyn Hillingdon. Do you agree?"
"If so," said Miss Marple, "there must be another woman."
"But what woman?"
Miss Marple shook her head in a dissatisfied manner.
"I can't help feeling, I really can't, that it's not all quite as simple as that."
"Well, who shall we consider next? Jackson? We'll leave me out of it."
Miss Marple smiled for the first time.
"And why do we leave you out of it, Mr. Raphael?"
"Because if you want to discuss the possibilities of my being a murderer, you'd have to do it with somebody else. Waste of time talking about it to me. And anyway, I ask you, am I cut out for the part? Helpless, hauled out of bed like a dummy, dressed, wheeled about in a chair, shuffled along for a walk. What earthly chance have I of going and murdering anyone?"
"Probably as good a chance as anyone else,"
said Miss Marple vigorously.
"And how'd you make that out?"
"Well, you would agree yourself, I think, that you have brains."
"Of course I've got brains," declared Mr. Raphael. "A good deal more than anybody else in this community, I'd say."
"And having brains," went on Miss Marple, "would enable you to overcome the physical difficulties of being a murderer.